much for the Buddha? How much for the Dharma? How much for the Sangha? Good morning. Thanks for being here today. Sound check, we're good on Zoom. Okay, so
Good.
on Wednesday evenings, during the fall, we always go through foundational teachings, the basics of Buddhism. And one of those foundational teachings is the Eightfold Path. And today I want to look at one of those. So there's suffering because of grasping, but it's not really a problem because there are eight things we can do to create an internal environment that doesn't grasp. And one of those eight things is right effort. And in a classic definition of right effort, the Buddha describes it like this. And what is right effort? There is a case where a practitioner generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts their intent for the sake of the non-arising of evil, unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen. They generate desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts their intent for the sake of abandonment of evil, unskillful qualities that have arisen. They generate desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts their intent for the sake of the arising of skillful qualities that have not yet arisen. And they generate desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts their intent for the maintenance, non-confusion, increase, plenitude, development, and culmination of skillful qualities that have arisen. This is called right effort. So that's the like Buddhist dictionary definition. That's found in Samyutpada Nikaya 45.8, if you want to look it up. Similar to the Brahma Viharas, we're always able to do at least one of those, right? One of those four, depending on our situation. In this case, with the four right efforts, we can prevent or abandon an unskillful state, or develop or maintain a skillful state. One of the prerequisites here is noticing the difference between a skillful and an unskillful state. And I would say, like we can tie ourselves into verbal knots there pretty easily, but at an experiential level, if you land with a bit of mindfulness, a fairly basic level of mindfulness, we can distinguish. Is this constricted? Is this expansive? So that's enough, really. That's not the whole of the practice there, but that initial part is really important and it's fairly easy. So these four activities are called the four right exertions, or the four exertions lumped under right effort. So we've got exertion, we've got effort. It's giving us some clue, right? That once we notice skillful or unskillful, there's something more. It's probably difficult. It probably takes some effort. It's very common to notice at some level that that I'm doing something unskillful, and then to convince myself that it's not necessary to put the effort in, right? It'll be fine. No one will notice. It's not my problem. That's just how I do it, or just who I am, right? Those sorts of adjustments. So that's the rub. That's the pivot point. That's where we're going with this talk. What makes it easier for that effort piece to happen? So far, so good. There's another famous discourse about effort in the numerical discourses, the Anguttara Nikaya in the sixes. There's the Sona Sutta. So this is a little bit broader view of this topic. In this sutta, there's a monk who is named Sona, and his background, like he's from a rich family, and and got ordained, into the renunciate life. And he's trying really, really hard, doing walking meditation until his feet are blistered and bleeding. And he's demoralized. And he's, skeptical doubt has arisen, and he's wondering if this is really the path for him. And the Buddha was listening in and appears in front of him and says, "Remember when you were, before you were a monk, you liked to play the lute. And how did it go when the strings were too loose? And how did it go when the strings were too taut?" And Sona catches the hint and puts just the right amount of effort in. And I'll quote that a little bit here. "So after that, Venerable Sona determined the right pitch for his persistence, attuned the pitch of his of the five faculties to that, and there picked up his theme. Dwelling alone, secluded, heedful, ardent, and resolute, he in no time reached and remained in the supreme goal of the holy life for which clansmen rightly go forth from home into homelessness, knowing and realizing it for himself in the here and now. He knew birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task done. There is nothing further for the sake of this world." And thus Venerable Sona became another one of the Arhants. And that's how that story is typically portrayed. And that's how I've heard it many times and read portions of it many times. But actually, that's less than half of the sutta. I looked it up for this talk and I realized, oh, wow, there's this whole other section here. And after Sona has his experience and becomes an Arhant, he thinks to himself, you know what? Like, I should really go, like, talk to the Buddha and tell him and display my understanding as an expression of gratitude. And so he does. And he, like, has this long, this is a drastic paraphrase. "Now, as an Arhant, I'm dedicated to six things." And you might be confused and think that Arahant is dedicated to one of these six things because of unskillful motives, but that's actually impossible. Attachment isn't happening. And so I'm really available to experience all of this sensation, and it's not a bother. Just like a mountain in a storm doesn't quiver and shake, I can just allow it all to arise and pass away. And that's the end of the sutra. And I think, and I that I was already like into this. I was interested in this topic, but that was really like, ah, that's what I'm talking about today. I think that mountain analogy is really important. It's there for the storms to roll in. It describes it in each of the cardinal directions. There's a storm coming, and it doesn't need to protect itself. It's not bothered. We get to be not bothered by the storm by being, the mountain gets to be not bothered by the storm because it's fully who it is, right? It's fully experiencing the storm without attachment to it being different. There's something that's just fun about that, right? Like, storms are kind of amazing. I understand that fun is not really the vibe of the Pali Canon, but I'm not talking about distraction and avoidance, right? I'm not talking about gratuitous following of sense desires. I'm not talking about a frivolity that makes it hard to land and be present. It's certainly possible to use fun as a way to escape or delay practice, dilute it. And, we probably all do some of that. And that's a near enemy of what I'm talking about. It's a miss. There's a quality of play, right, with practice. When I'm immersed in something, especially when it has a fairly significant sensory or kinesthetic component, I'm engaged in the activity but not attached to a particular outcome or approach. Like, that is just fun. If I'm attached to an outcome or a method, right, usually that starts to tilt towards for me, kind of a competitiveness. That's my slant. It's less fun. It's less like play. There's some gray area there, and we each have to get familiar with our own karmic landscape. But a mind state either has unwholesome qualities or it doesn't, right? There's either attachment or there's not attachment. It's a binary quality. And so there's a wide range of how subtle or coarse that attachment is. But we can notice, is it present? And broadly, if we're not experiencing attachment, we can tap into that play, playfulness. And there's both a purposefulness about the activity and the lightness about like who we are in relation to it, what it means about us. And that's a pretty wholesome quality. Hongzhi has a Dharma discourse about, he encourages us to roam and play in samadhi, right? Bringing that quality of unattached exploration and engagement into meditation, right? It just keeps being fresh. It just keeps being new, this. For Soji, which is like the little temple cleaning period we do before breakfast here at the temple every morning. In the last week, I've been shoveling out the stormwater culvert in the ravine. This time of year, it fills up with leaves, and if it gets blocked enough to prevent enough water flow, it's a problem. It can have washouts. So we try to keep it clear. In a related subject, the preschoolers like to build dams. Yeah. So building dams is super fun, right? We did a like a while ago, a long time ago, we did this Dharma school camp out, and we spent most of the day building dams and making channels. It was great. Yuka and I did a bunch of some pretty serious dam building this summer during the swimming period at Dharma camp. There's this quality of challenge, of constraint. Like the water just keeps on coming. You get to see it. The situation is constantly changing. It's very sensory, a lot of motor, tactile, visual stimulation. Right? There's an open-endedness about the goal and how to accomplish it. Right? You might be doing one thing and then someone else is doing this, and it's a whole new ball game. So there's this improvisational quality. So all of that is describing play. And I think these moments are more accessible than we might imagine and more useful to practice than we might imagine. One of the realms in which I do access this regularly is kitchen cleanup. Right after a meal, we clean the kitchen. It's basically building a dam, right? There's different places you might slot in. You might be the dishwasher or the dryer or the sweeper or the putter away or the, whatever. There's a basic goal, right? We basically recognize when we're done, but it's loose, right? It's interactive and largely in a parallel way. And I've gotten to know my own like particular karmic landscape around this activity. And so that I'm pretty good at turning it into playtime. And for me, the juice is in discovery of like, what's the expedient means? Like, how do we get from A to B as like simply and quickly as possible? Like that's the excitement. Not because there's a time limit or because I have more important things to do or cleaning the kitchen is averse from trying to get past it, but just because like, that's more fun, right? It's sharp. It adds aliveness to the equation for me. It brings, like, it makes it more vivid.
Thank
For
you.
some, that doesn't make it more vivid, right? That's not interesting. The juice is all about the sensation of like soapy water or the like repartee in the kitchen, whatever. There's different different ways in, and we're all doing it a little differently, and we're all in the same container, affecting each other, adapting to each other. And of course, it might very well be drudgery, right? It might be obligation. It might be deadening. So, right effort, right? That's attachment. That's unwholesome mind state appearing. Deadening and obligation feel constricting. We're less alive in moments of feeling obligation. So, thinking about the four exertions, can we abandon that? It's an unwholesome state that has arisen. Can we see through it? Can we see past it? Or prevent it from arising? You know the loops, little verbal loops that we tend to run, the ways in which we could look for resentment, we could look for hecticness or whatever, and prevent that from arising and invite instead a sense of play. If you're hearing me say fun or play or words like that during a Dharma talk and find that or think that this might not be relevant to you, I want to clarify a little bit here. We have lots of associations with those words, right? And a lot of us have painful associations, right? There's wounds around belonging, around worth, around obligation, responsibility, privilege, opportunity, right? We all have our own map. One truth that's relevant here is that mind states are really short, right? They are flickers. Who we are is ephemeral. And so it's not like the whole 14 minutes of clean the kitchen scene is a uniform, uninterrupted chunk of delight for me. It's hundreds of thousands of nen, right? Mind moments. So part of how I practice with right effort in that context is I notice states that include delight, that are enlivening. And I tilt in that direction. I pour attention there. That's the maintaining piece, the fourth of the exertions. I value that. And so I lean into it. And that encourages those fleeting moments to spread out a little, to connect perhaps. But over the course of that 14 minutes or whatever it is, I experience a lot of different sensations. Right? If resentment arises based on someone else's choices about how they're going to clean the kitchen, like I shoot for the second exertion and try to abandon that unskillful mind state. One of the tells for me in my own mindfulness, if I'm like doing this or not, is when I mess up, right? If I'm in a state of like closer to play, then like mistakes usually read more as humor or celebration, right? Like it's feedback that's helpful. And if there's attachment in the mix, if I'm in one of the unwholesome mind states, mistakes read like failure, right? Like, and there's critical self-talk and it hurts. So that's one of those like really useful little signals on the dashboard. So the point being, don't think about the overall activity as needing to be play. Think about specific moments as playful, right? As I was writing this talk, I looked out the window. This is early morning. And I watched a few seconds of sunrise. Part of that was imagining the next steps and what was going to happen, you know, how the swirls were turning from purple to pink, how the backdrop was going from ink to slate. And the light, you know, that arose. So there was a sense of purpose, like I was intentionally grounding. I was intentionally kind of reconnecting with the talk of embodiment in my experience. What am I actually sensing? Of there was some creativity there. All elements of play, and we can find those, you know, being a mountain in a storm, building a dam, doing kitchen cleanup, writing a talk. We might not find them. It may feel like a job, like a have to, just another task on a list that we need to cross out. But hopefully we can remember some of those elements which make it, which create the possibility of this being delightful, being creative, and look for them. If something is missing, like the sense of purpose, like why do I care about this? What's the yearning, right? We can add that. Maybe what's missing is the sense of absorption in the activity, that we're really giving ourselves to it, we're wholehearted. Maybe we're missing the sensory piece and we're a little dissociated, a little numb, a little pulled back. Tune in the mindfulness so it can be more vivid, right? Maybe it's the flexibility piece where we have some belief that it has to go a certain way. And what does it take to soften that? What do I need to accentuate to move this from have to get to? Frog Song, my preschool here, leverages the heck out of this. It's really important for children's development that they play, that they spend time exploring in this way. It's a primary mode of learning. This preschool teaches all these different activities. They're called works in that context. But they're really actually taught as play, the way I'm talking about it. So the kids can do whatever work they want as long as they've had instruction on how to do it. And they go through the day just kind of following their organic wish. What makes me feel most alive of who they are in that moment? And they're learning problem solving. They're learning adaptability to change and setback. They're socializing all these basics, which are relevant forever. Part of being able to tilt towards this mode of being is that it speeds up learning, right? Like we're more receptive to feedback. We invite it. We're available to richer and more frequent, more immediate feedback, which is vulnerable. Like it's a mirror. We're watching ourselves. But one of the reasons it's fun is because it's authentic. And notice folks who spend more time in that kind of a playful state. It's kind of like an emotional wetland in terms of being able to deal with floods, right? There's just greater capacity to meet the storms of life. This sounds an awful lot like practice to me. Thich Nhat Hanh has a quote, play is training for the real thing, but the real thing is also play, which I think is true, or it can be. many temples on the, so we have this big wooden block out there that you heard before meditation that calls us in for Zazen. And on many temples, there's an inscription on it. And it goes something like, life is transient and swiftly passing. Wake up to the great matter of birth and death. Do not waste time. And in some places, that's what they, that's the last thing you hear at night. Someone says that. Dogen in Fukan Zazengi reminds us that we are taking care of the essential activity of the Buddha way, and we should not spend our days and nights in vain. So I agree with that. I don't think, like, this talk is in agreement with those sentiments. And I think it's easy to kind of like use that line from Fukan Zazengi, don't spend days and nights in vain, or use the do not waste time on the Han as kind of a cudgel, as kind of a I'm not enough. And that is not wholesome activity. That's not reality. It's practice and play are both important and can be doorways into each other, and we can take them both very seriously. And that's a wholesome way in. So I think this talk is sort of an invitation to lean more in that direction, to test that for yourself in your life. What are some ways in which you might tilt dour, you might tilt solemn, and that you could offer a little more creativity to yourself?
If you're in the room, please raise your hand and I will bring the microphone to you. Please say your name before you offer your question or comment, and hold the microphone close to your mouth so people on Zoom can hear you clearly. If you're on Zoom, you can either put your name or your question, and Kay will unmute you or read the question out for you.
My name is Guy. Thank you for your talk. As you were ending it, I couldn't help but remember this marvelous song by Victor Jara called La Tormenta, the storm. And this is a horrible storm and inundating this poor neighborhood. People are desperately trying to pull their belongings out of their houses and save themselves. And in the middle of the storm, he sees this little kid who's playing with a little can, like a pop can that is being, you know, pushed along by the storm, and he's pretending to be a captain, and this is his ship that he's piloting, you know, and he says, sometimes, you know, all you can do is just laugh, you know.
Yeah. Well, and I hope the kid was safe. You know, like, both are true. Like, I want to have access to, like, you know, drop into the moment, and I don't want to dissociate from what's happening around me, and so, you know, like, it's this ongoing discernment about, like, what's needed in this moment, like, what's my level of capacity, and what's needed around me. We have Amy and Genko.
This is Amy. I love right effort conversation. And I think my question is for those of us that are, like, big tryhards. Because when you mentioned, like, tilting towards solemn, And then there's also this other group of us that are like overly playful. Mm-hmm. Or like, I was looking at the board over there with like all the activities. Mm-hmm. I was like, where's the Dharma bowling club? Or like, where's the fun group? But anyway, that's a separate thing. I was just thinking about the like how when you were talking about the kitchen and like there's, you know, those of us who gamify everything or like because challenge is so, it's not really about perfectionism so much as like just loving challenges. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, a big catch for Zen. Like the thing that made me be like, it's going to be the Zen Buddhism was the work practice. It's like, this is for me. And like, it's a big trap because then it's also over efforting is the flip side of no, right? It's mm-hmm, like, that's mm-hmm. then the effort becomes not efforting. Mm-hmm. Like if you're trying to, right? So it just gets a little confusing for me.
Yeah, sure. Sure. No, great. Like work practice is sort of my home base in the practice realm. It's really consistent. That's a very useful way in for me. Long before meditation was, this like work practice was the gateway. And I think like there's many right effort conversations. And that dissolution into like ease and one of the traps with right effort is seeing the trying to accomplish something is usually because there's some deficit, there's some issue, there's some problem, and that's part of what's like fascinating about play is that like there doesn't have to be, right? Like this can be perfect as it is, like you don't, like nothing's needed, and still like there's a way to like pour yourself into the activity, and so like attachment or not, like how much am I giving myself a story that like it needs to be a particular way in order for whatever, I catch myself doing that, and I've gotten more comfortable with the reset, with trusting that like exactly how it needs to be, right? Like that's true in a deep way, and it's a matter of like how frequently do I need to reset? Yeah.
I was just thinking like when you said does it have to be a certain way. Versus instead of thinking about the outcome, because I'm usually not like, I need a perfect outcome, but I'm like, it has to be hard though.
You're a challenge junkie. Sure. I think, you know, part of the, and that's one of the things also, like gave me the sense that like, oh, this is going to work for me because Zen didn't collude with me there. The challenge is it just gets more subtle, right? And so we have to be in like kind of a like we have to hold it lighter and lighter as we get deeper. And so it's working against that, like, oh, give me that challenge, like make me notice. There is this kind of like self-correcting like mechanism in there.
Thank you for your talk. This is Mikio. And since you talked about dishwashing, I just did a dishwashing last night. And, you know, when I was growing up, I never did wash dish ever. But somehow, you know, I started to do it. I don't think I ever really liked it. Mm-hmm. But last night, you know, well, I make dinner and dishes after that too. And then she was preparing some food for the gathering she was going. So I ended up with a lot more than usual. Mm-hmm. And, but when I was doing it and after that, it's like, I was like, oh, look at this clean kitchen counter. Look at this, you know, clean cookie sheet. And I felt happy and I felt kind of weird about that. So, but I guess it's a good direction.
Yeah. Often if we're following the script, like we're frustrated, right? Like that's a culturally normal mode, right? To be kind of put upon. And so mindfulness gives us a chance to notice like, actually, it's okay. Like there's like, I could put my attention on lots of aspects of my experience. There's way more going on right now than I could notice at any one moment. And so I get to kind of choose like how I want to spend that attention. And I could spend it on rehearsing the script of like, this isn't fair and she should have washed her own dishes or, you know, whatever. That's one place I could pour that. But I could also like it feels really good to just like immerse yourself in the sense of satisfaction, like countertops are clean, like soak it up.
Yeah. So I used to feel like, you know, like clean kitchen is what she wants.
Identity. Yeah.
Yeah. Identity. And now yeah, felt like last night I was saying, it doesn't matter. So
that's good. That's the creativity piece, right? Like, you know, so there's like these cultural scripts about how we are in the world, but there's also like all these things which like I've told myself over time about who I am. And we get to keep discovering.
Thank you.
Tony has a question on Zoom.
Hi, Tony.
Hi, can you hear?
Yep.
Okay. The question specifically about effort in Zazen, as you know, one who over efforted for many, many years, you know, grinding away, it eventually and actually fairly recently, you know, got through to me that that's not necessarily what I need to do. And now I've been suffering persistently in the other direction, you know. I mean, I'm relaxing too much. Now, there has to actually be some effort. And, you know, eventually I noticed that I'm not putting in any effort, I'm just sitting there. Is there a very basic question? Is there some more skillful way I can shorten the time toward noticing and adding a little bit of genuine effort into the situation?
You know, one thing I might try is if I feel like if that's been a pattern for me over the course of a week or something, one thing that I will do is start the meditation period with 5 minutes of some kind of directed meditation, something that's more explicit, more obvious, and then like let that dissolve into shikantaza. And it just sort of like establishes, it sort of reminds the system like, oh, right, this is what I'm doing. And then you can kind of let the boundaries disappear.
Yes, okay, that sounds very plausible, thank you.
Yes.
Better than plausible, it actually works, yes.
Hi, this is Genko. At the beginning of your talk, you're talking about effort and exertion. I thought, but what about non-effort? And I think some of the questions and some of the things you said sort of are touching on this. Mm-hmm. When it becomes play, it doesn't feel effortful in the sense of I have to really consciously put a lot of stuff into it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember leaving one of the prison groups that I've done and just thinking that was easy and fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, to answer Amy's question about where's the fun, it's like we find fun in what we're doing. At least I do. And somebody said recently to me that I think you have a lot of fun. And I said, it's true. I have a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at me, I'm just not looking very wild and crazy. I don't know. So I remember hearing early on that you have to find that balance between effort and non-effort. And that's one of the things we talk about for the Three Robes session mm-hmm. every year.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry for that. There was something I wanted to make about that. I think a lot of this is a matter of balancing rest practice. That was the other thing I was thinking of, is that for me, as I age, I have to sometimes be really sort of intentional about saying, I need to rest right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then also be aware of when it's getting to be too much. And I'm like getting into this habit of always like vegging out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting kind of ongoing koan about how do you balance all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that was my, like the piece about do not waste time at the end of the talk, like exploring that, you know, how we balance self-care and like attunement to what we need, which is important. That's part of living a human life. we have to be realistic about what we need and give ourselves that. And like, you know, there's a lot of scripts around what we think we need. And I really trust this sort of like drop in, like give yourself that moment of like kind of cease from you. We're just like ceasing. Like, what do I want? Like, what, like, where's the impulse? What direction? And like, I find like usually it's towards something, right? Like there's something calling, and I'm pretty connected to my like, you know, sense of purpose in life, and so there's a lot that I can move towards. And I mean that's what the preschoolers are doing, right? Like, okay, I've finished crushing the eggshells, now what am I going to do? Like, you know, they're learning how to tune into that natural arising. Yeah.
On Zoom, One Eyed Jack's commented, I end every sit with telling myself, and that is what that looked like. To sit in a state of intention and self-forgiveness without judgment and attachment to whatever happens moment to moment. To allow, permit, accept, and include within the intention of the effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds very wholesome to me. Like that really reminding yourself of that really broad field, that whatever it is, this is welcome. And, you know, we start from that, like offering awareness.
So we heard the Buddha's definition of right effort. What's your definition of right effort?
I think that for myself, that I'm putting energy in and it's bringing me like, I'm becoming more alive, more engaged, more like part of the experience. right? And there's something about that 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 feels like significant, like there's some importance to it in a way. It doesn't have to, that's an internal sense of like mattering, meaning. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Julia. Could you read the section from the definition that included the piece about intention, or I think the word is intention.
Yeah. So for each of the four exertions, there's this, they all mention intention. Then the intent for the sake of the, that's what changes, non-arising of evil, or the abandonment of evil, or the arising of skillful qualities, or the maintenance, et cetera, of skillful qualities.
Is it still a right effort if, like, the intention is put upon you and you're, like, living into it? The example that I have for this is get to interact with baseball team managers, and they expect me to approach them in a very specific way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have varying levels of up to that on any given day. But like sometimes there's really tense times of the year where we're still running numbers and we're still in the act of gathering data, and I'm taking a meeting and someone might, you know, Joey's just like, you know, where are the numbers? I can't make decisions until the numbers are here. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wasn't that God's honest truth? You know, and I, I'm like living into this, like, I don't know, the baseball lexicon.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And I leave the meeting like,
what just happened?
But at the same time, I sometimes leave the meeting like, did I pick that for myself? And does that even matter?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm hearing that as an authenticity question of like, you know, how much of that is, you know, the kind of expedient means of like, you know, meeting this specific situation, you know, that it's got its own rules and context and relationships. And, you know, which might be skillful, which might be like helpful, and how much of that is like, just kind of like losing touch with yourself so that there's less conflict in a way, kind of a, you know, escaping. And, you know, I think like what we tend to find with like things like that is like, it's messy. Like there's often a mix. And over the course of like an interview, like you might have moments of each, and the progression is just like catching it faster. Right. It's not that, it's like the last comment about the period of Zazen, and like, that's what happened. But it's not like that was the entire period of Zazen or that entire, like, you know, interview. All these different mind moments and then letting it be like interesting like that. So like, what was the, like, you know, picking the moments where you did feel like, I lost it. I lost touch with myself. Like, what happened right before that? And what was I telling myself about that? And why did I feel like I didn't have a, like, what was the specific constraint that I was feeling? Like, that's kind of my process there with those sorts of things. Just bringing more curiosity into it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Maybe time for one or two more.
Hi, thank you for the talk. Thank you for the mic. you guys just described my life like the last 10 years. So I'm thinking I need connection and I need compassion. And it's not always looking like that. So then I think, what do I do? Because here's where I'm at. And it's the breath. Go back to the breath. This is what I've learned. And then look at the mind. And move on or whatever. Take a breath. Get past that because there's another one coming.
I agree.
Well, I'm happy that you heard me.
Yeah.
I wish the other were. Because 10 years. And I don't want to go to the baseball game anymore. But I will. And then I'll breathe. And then I'll look at my mind.
Thank you.
Hello. Thank you for the Dharma talk. Mm-hmm. I'm new here. But my question is, if play is a way of trying to get to some sense of right effort,
mm-hmm.
Then and that like kind of asks us to detach ourselves from a specific outcome,
mm-hmm.
then when we have goals that are, and to ease like the situation or the example that are mm-hmm. principled goals,
mm-hmm.
they're like, how do we ensure that our right effort is aligning with that
right
goal?
That's great. So what I would say is that like when I'm thinking about like the that kind of that sense of meaning, that sense of purpose, goal, there's layers to it. And like the first layer I sense is usually like cognitive, right? And so that's usually kind of like specific and concrete and particular. And I wanna acknowledge, okay, that's part of it. What else is there? And like, you know, there's usually a drop or two. And somewhere under that, there's like what's really basic about that? Like, why does that particular cognitive thing matter to me? And like, it's going to be something basic, like caring or love or connection or understanding, like something really foundational that's fundamental that we're all looking for. And like, if I'm orienting how I do this activity based on like this model, it's probably tight. And if I orient based on like how I feel it like deep in the body, like that could go in so many different directions. And like, and that's a powerful like force to feel driving me. Yeah.
Thank you.
Maybe there's one more. quick one.
So my name's Kayin. For those of you who don't know, I'm the assistant teacher at Frog Song at the preschool. And we had a morning, I think last week, where I was in the classroom and our lead teacher showed up a little bit later and she was like, how did the morning go? And I was like, well, I didn't really feel like a lot of work happened this morning. And she looked at me and she smiled and she said, work can take many forms. That's all.
Thank you. It's a nice note to end.